ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Jack McLennan was 27, fit and visibly strong.
He was trained well. He knew how to hit, and I was gobsmacked.
He seemed ready for anything, but then he suddenly vanished.
I was just talking to him last night. Like, how the hell does that happen?
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is birthday season in America. 250 years for the Republic, 80 years for the Donald.
And what's the perfect birthday gift for someone who has everything?
I don't know, Waleed. Greenland, perhaps?
Yes. But if you can't get that, you want a cage-fighting spectacular at the White House. I'm Waleed Ali.
I'm Hamish McDonald, and on this episode of Global Roaming, one of us might actually sing Happy Birthday, Mr. President. Yeah, that'd be worth hanging around for, right, Waleed? It's probably more likely to... You're far more musical than me, so maybe I'll leave it to you.
Yeah, but that, I think, is why you need to be the one to do it. Just so I can give you feedback and we can improve the process. Hey, now, by the way, I have to admit, it's been like this for years for me, but whenever I think cage fighting, I think Hamish McDonald. And so I'm interested in your take on exactly what Donald Trump is proposing to do here.
Yeah, I've got to stop sending you those photos of me in a wrestling suit, don't I, Willie? Oh, look, I've got to say UFC is not my thing, but I've certainly seen these images of the enormous stage being built on the South Lawn of the White House. And it's striking in part because there is so much construction going on at the White House. Of course, he's building his own, or knocked down a wing to build a big ballroom. Even just seeing those before and after shots of the Oval Office pre-Trump's time, just how much bling and gold has been added is really quite striking. And honestly, like, I don't really get it. I don't understand how, to coincide with the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, Trump is also throwing himself an 80th birthday party, and he's doing it with effectively blood sports out the back deck.
Yeah, these things are converging, aren't they? I think I just want to make a couple of observations about UFC, though, that might be handy for our audience. So I'm not a UFC fan. I'm not a mixed martial arts fan. I do know quite a few people who are, though. I think the way UFC operates and works in Australia is perhaps quite different to the way that works in the United States. And there are different kinds of UFC fans. So you've got some who they want the blood sport, they want the cage fight, and people who don't get UFC, they focus on that. But then I think of people I know who are themselves, you know, black belts in martial arts or whatever, and they see a highly technical, really intriguing matchup in different fighting styles, for example. You know when, I'm sure you did this as well as I did, Hamish, you know when you're in the playground at primary school and you were like, do you think Superman would beat like the Flash in a fight? And the UFC kind of becomes the moment, wow, you can actually test it. Like which martial art wins and, you know, and it so often ends up on the floor and the holding ones beat the striking ones and all this stuff I don't really understand. So there is that side of it and it's a big mainstream event. But in Australia, I don't think it's political. In America, there is mainstream appeal, but it has been so closely associated with Donald Trump throughout his presidency, and even through the figure of Dana White, who's of course the organizer, one of the key architects of this whole UFC movement. So it has a meaning, I think, in America that we perhaps don't quite appreciate here.
If we're sort of trying to wrap our head around this moment, is it fair to observe, do you think, that this stage that's being built and whatever it is that unfolds, kind of takes us to that intersection of the manosphere, Joe Rogan and all the podcasting ecosystem, the Dana White's, this character you've just mentioned, we're going to hear a lot more about him because he's got real political influence, but also the way in which Trump does politics and has built this mad, messy coalition across America of support that no other political figure has been able to kind of bind together in such a successful way.
Yeah, so it's really interesting, I think. The remaking of the political landscape and of political alliances does show up in culture generally. I mean, we're seeing culture fracturing, but that UFC is a particular cultural phenomenon, I think. And the way you describe it, it's actually quite useful there. It also is a thing that, like Trump himself, instills a lot of passion. I've interviewed Dana White once.
Oh,
and
really?
Not on my own. It was a panel interview on a show that I think you might be familiar with as well. And But it was really interesting. So I had what I regarded as being quite a fun exchange about his intentions with it. And my suggestion to him was he quite likes the scandal of, you know, certain fighters saying certain outrageous things or whatever. And to me, it was just a fairly lighthearted exchange. The level of blowback that I got from UFC fans, often indirectly, like via family members who weren't UFC fans, but their kids were or whatever, the response was just totally out of proportion to the stature of that interview, and what had even happened in that interview. I think that says something about what UFC does, that it touches a nerve deep within certain cohorts of people. That's Trump, right? That's what Trump does. So in some ways, the meeting of these things at this cultural moment and this political moment, and by moment, I mean really the last decade, there's something about it that is just the perfect distillation, I think, of a series of phenomena.
And I mean, it's not like you to ask a niggly question that then provokes a disproportionately passionate response from a broad cross-section of people.
That's why I was so shocked, Hamish. It's just such an alien thing.
But this anniversary that is on the horizon for the United States, it is a big one. 250 years since the Declaration of Independence. This is an important moment for a country that is trying to, I suppose, reassert itself on the world stage, if you like, or redefine itself, whichever way you want to look at everything that's happening right now. It does, at least on the face of it, seem a strange way to start the celebrations. It's not the only thing. There's going to be this Freedom 250 concert, as they would call it there, although I note a bunch of the performers pulling out, saying it's becoming far more political than what they thought it would be. How do you think it's all going to unravel?
Well, I think Donald Trump is redefining the symbolic meaning of America in several ways. I mean, obviously in policy and economic policy, probably the most marked way, its relationship with the world, all those sorts of things. So we're definitely seeing that. But also that means the redefinition of the nation or the concept of the nation and the way it sees itself. I mean, I think until Trump arrives, genuinely arrives in the White House, the United States presents itself to the world in very civic terms, doesn't it? You know, you can be American and anything else. It's about individual freedom, the Constitution, all these sorts of things. Now, all of a sudden, it's being repackaged in ways that we might understand through more traditionally nationalist language, you know, military might, being great again. But what does greatness mean? Well, it means dominance. It doesn't mean size or even prosperity necessarily, but it means winning, like all these sorts of things. But my guess is that's what you'll see in the 250th anniversary celebrations, and that's part of the thing that some people are balking at. When they say it feels more political, arguably it's always political, right? I think what they mean is it's presenting the country in a very different sort of a way that feels political because it's a departure from what the default has been for however many decades. But then that's the Trump presidency, right? I mean, name a respect in which that's not true.
Well, let's get to our guest. Sean Gregory is joining us from Time magazine. He's a sports correspondent, but he's actually just written this big profile on Dana White, who we've mentioned a couple of times. He's Donald Trump's friend. He's the guy that has, I guess, turned UFC into the big thing that it is today. But as that's grown, its influence has grown, and so too has Dana White's. Let's meet Sean Gregory.
Sean, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you so much. Great meeting you.
Why does the White House lawn look like this?
Because 25 years ago in Atlantic City, Donald Trump hosted a UFC event, the first event that current UFC CEO Dana White ran as president, as head of the UFC back in 2001. Him and his business partner had bought the UFC for $2 million, very cheap back then. It was kind of a fringe organization. Politicians said it was too violent. Cable carriers wouldn't put it on pay-per-view. But Trump decided to give his casino over to the UFC. He went to the event, met Dana White, loved the UFC, loved the violence of the UFC, and they've kind of been tight ever since. As the UFC kind of grew, Trump would regularly give Dana White notes of encouragement. Then, you know, fast forward to 2016, President Trump's running for president. Dana White is one of the speakers at the Republican National Convention. 2024, 5 days after he was almost assassinated, Dana White introduces Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention. President Trump wins the 2024 election, goes to the Madison Square Garden for a UFC fight 11 days later. At these fights, he's applauded, he is lauded, and he leaned over to Dana White as president-elect and said, "Hey, Dana, we should have a fight at the White House." And then a few months later, talks commenced, and here we are.
when you describe it that way, it brings to mind all of these comparisons that people are making with a Roman Empire sitting in front of gladiators. And I often think like these historical comparisons are wrong. They're too simplistic. They don't really do much of a service. But what do you think?
No, I think you're right. I mean, that might be going too far. I think some people do say that. Listen, it's a sports event. The UFC it's a $1.5 billion business. They've hosted events, I think, five continents, including, I think they're very popular in Australia. They go, I think some of their biggest, most attended events are in Australia. So, you know how big it is. And so, you know, it's the one sporting event that you can have on the White House lawn. It's hard to do a baseball game there, hard to do an outdoor basketball game. Like, so there is a Venn diagram of interests of, UFC fans tend to be young men. Donald Trump did very well with young men in the last election voting-wise. So, yeah, the Roman Empire comparison, there's something to that, but I agree, it's quite different than that.
Every president seems to have their sport, though, Sean. I mean, I remember that how big a sensation it was when Barack Obama got sworn in, and I started hearing stories about lobbyists who were working on their basketball game when golf was, of course, the traditional presidential sport. We haven't seen a UFC president before until now. I suppose my question then relates to what lens is the right lens to look at this through here, because we couldn't look at it as this is just a sport, the president likes this sport, that's it. There's another lens that says, yeah, but it's on the White House lawn, it coincides with his birthday, the 250th anniversary of the country, this is a big political thing. It's all about creating a certain kind of mission. Another is just very personal for Trump. He's entertaining himself. He likes doing stuff. He has a thing to do. I'm interested in what lens you think is the appropriate one for something like this.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I asked the president during our interview for our cover story, why of all the activities UFC? And he says, because I like it. There wasn't much about the fighting spirit of America, the entrepreneurial spirit of America. It was just, he likes it. Dana White, I asked him, isn't it inherently political to have a sporting event on the lawn of the White House? He said, you can make anything political. No, this is for everybody on the left, everybody on the right. Anybody can enjoy this fight. Anybody can watch this fight. At the end of the day, it is a sporting event. It's a unique setting. They say no taxpayer money is going into it. The UFC is losing money on it because they're not charging tickets. So for the UFC, it's basically a marketing ploy. And for the president, it's a night out in his backyard that he's presumably going to really enjoy.
But events, sporting and otherwise, do come laden with a certain set of values. I mean, let's imagine, for example, that there's a President Hillary Clinton to pick, or Kamala Harris, and she were hosting in the White House a women's basketball game, like an NBA, a WNBA All-Stars game or something like that. No one would describe that, I think, as a neutral event. They would describe that as some kind of symbol of women's empowerment or something like that. There'd be a narrative that would be clearly capable of being established there.
Right.
UFC does embody a certain set of values. That's to it. It's very masculine. These things that you've kind of noticed. Are we to believe that Donald Trump is, I don't know, not thinking of those things? That he's
no, for sure. Donald Trump, particularly in 2024, had to appeal to what's become known as the manosphere. And it's embodied by Robert Kennedy Jr., kind of a male-centric ethos of health tips and biohacking and alternative medicines, vaccine skepticism, all this stuff. And the right-wing podcasts that, for example, that Dana White connected Donald Trump to in 2024, these guys who had Donald Trump on their podcast, and Donald Trump reached huge audiences, Joe Rogan among them, they're all UFC fans. So he's in his comfort zone here. The New York Times wrote that the rise of Donald Trump simultaneously with Dana White, who's now on the board of Meta, the company formerly known as Facebook, and Mark Zuckerberg said, we need more masculine energy in corporate America. We need aggressiveness. And so if Donald Trump and Dana White are ushering in, as the New York Times said, a new masculinist mainstream in the United States and perhaps globally, this is the epitome of that.
So maybe it's helpful to just think of this as an emblem for all the other craziness that we see going on in America today.
For sure. I mean, there is an undeniable Donald Trump rough and tumble politics, saying whatever you want, unfiltered. He's very unfiltered. And that's Dana White's very unfiltered. The UFC is very unfiltered. You might hear fighters say some crazy things on the White House lawn. Yeah, they're definitely, it represents a moment in America right now that is embodied by the President of the United States, for sure.
I'm Waleed Ali. I'm here with Hamish McDonald today. This is Global Roaming. And we're talking to Sean Gregory from Time Magazine about President Trump's plan for his 80th birthday. Let's be honest, we're talking about the fact that he's staging a big cage fight at the White House.
Can you maybe explain for our listeners a bit more about who Dana White is and how he's accrued all of this power and influence?
Yeah, so he had a tough childhood, grew up partially in Vegas, finished high school in Maine with relatives because his mom basically kicked him out of their place in Las Vegas. It was kind of bouncing around Boston, had a bellhop job, but always wanted to get into the fight business. He think he took up boxing in his late teens. So he quit his bellhop job and got in with a local Boston trainer, promoter, kind of learned the boxing business, moves back to Vegas, and as he tells it, he was getting extorted by the Boston Mafia, kind of flees to Las Vegas, meets back up with high school classmate Lorenzo Fertitta, who's a casino heir. And so now Dana White is in Vegas managing boxers, managing a few MMA fighters, mixed martial arts, and again, realizes that the UFC is available. Now, the UFC is the organization that promotes mixed martial arts. And back in the mid-90s, it was very, very violent. There weren't as many rules, and the politicians were just killing it. Dana White said, we can get this at a cheap price, kind of clean it up, organize it. And what was a really big moment for them was in 2005, they started running this reality show on a cable station in the U.S., Spike TV, called The Ultimate Fighter. It was a reality show, and the whole thing was like, whoever wins this competition could get a spot at the UFC, and those people started watching the fights, paying for the fights, and the business grew from there.
Reading all of this story, I actually found it kind of an interesting parallel for all of the disruption that's happened in the Republican Party, because John McCain had actually played a big role in basically railing against the fact that it lacked rules, sort of wanted to reform it. Now Dana White says, actually, it's thanks to him that it's become this more palatable, profitable product. It's kind of an interesting, I guess, kind of cross story there with what's happened to the Republicans.
Yeah, no, you know, the maverick John McCain was against it. And then later in life did, you know, give Dana White credit for boxing, for example, has a million sanctioning organizations. And Dana White was clever in saying, you know what, unlike boxing, let's make UFC the organization for MMA. We'll get all the fighters under our umbrella. We'll divide it up into weight classes, get it on pay-per-view, produce it in a certain way. The Ultimate Fighter reality show got more, spread the word about it, got people to sample these fights. You know, the fights have a lot more action. And there's a bunch of fights on the card culminating in a main event. The rounds are shorter. They go a little faster. So it kind of fits the attention span of the 21st century a little bit better than long 10-round boxing fights. So it was kind of a perfect storm. But yeah, politically, you know, McCain was definitely, you know, the 90s in the United States, family values, religious right. And this was like the opposite of that. Now, Donald Trump has flipped that around because his family values isn't exactly on top of his, he says sometimes, but it's not the top of his. He's all about getting stuff done in his mind, and rough and tumble, being unfiltered, being rough, and, you know, raising his fist when he almost gets killed, making a lot of that moment, that performative moment, and this is going to be another example of that.
So the youth masculinity is part of this, what you're talking about. I think that brings us to the political equation that's really fascinating here, because Donald Trump's victory in 2024 was built in no small part on the support of young men. You mentioned Joe Rogan, for example. Joe Rogan's endorsement, that style of podcaster, the bro podcaster, was a big element of it. I think Donald Trump got something like 49% of the young male vote, which just should not happen for a Republican candidate. But since, that support has tanked. I mean, we're talking about approval ratings for what they're worth, somewhere between, like, let's say 25 and I think 33% maybe at the upper limit. This event is the kind of thing that would speak to them. I just wonder how you think this will be received in that context of falling support amongst that demographic. Do they see this as a cheap, cynical kind of thing, or are they inclined to? Or do they go, oh yeah, that's right, that's the guy we fell in love with back in 2024. I just don't know how this lands.
I don't think that cohort will object to this fight just based only on the numbers that we've seen. It's the business of the UFC will not suffer because of Trump's falling ratings. There's another interesting thing about this whole thing is Paramount, which is run by a Trump ally, David Ellison, bought the media rights to the UFC last year for $7 billion over 7 years. So the UFC is getting twice the media rights money that they did under the old deal with ESPN in the US. But yes, I asked Dana White this. Are you worried about this? And I asked some Wall Street analysts, will Donald Trump's ratings, approval ratings tanking affect the UFC bottom line? The Wall Street analysts say no. People who love UFC are going to love UFC no matter what Donald Trump is doing. Maybe not as many people clap for him, but they're not worried right now. I think there's going to be a curiosity factor. Now, the UFC is betting that these new people that watch it are going to start becoming UFC fans. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen. Obviously, time will tell.
It sounds like this is really going to benefit Dana White and the UFC. It's really going to benefit Paramount and the Ellisons, potentially. Does anyone ask Trump whether he's doing this to use public office to benefit his corporate friends?
Yeah, I mean, sure. Yes. So, and there has been news stories that he's gotten some criticism that he's bought stock in the company that is TKO that is running this event. So, yes, everyone's kind of interrelated. He's friends with David Ellison. And yes, this is going to be huge for Paramount that night. You know, but this is how this president has always kind of run business. He's always kind of tiptoed around these conflicts of interest. So, yeah, I mean, there are questions about it, but are people still curious to watch this and are fight fans psyched about it? Yes.
Isn't this bordering on corruption, misuse of public office, all those sorts of things?
I mean, they're saying that the UFC is paying for everything. Okay. So, you know, until we see, are people donating to his Republican midterm candidates and to his political funds for a ticket? They're saying that most of the tickets are going to military personnel. Is there underhanded dealing to get in that might come out? For sure, that could come out. We haven't really seen much evidence of that yet.
So that's Trump financially, but what about Trump politically? Is this useful for him in some way? Do you see this as being able to, I don't know, arrest?
I mean, it can't hurt him. I don't think it's going to hurt him if it's a, you know, if it's just an embarrassing disaster. You know, there's worry about weather, there's worry about bugs, like all kinds of unpredictable things can happen outdoors in Washington in June. If the fighters are misbehaving and it's just ugly, yeah, that could hurt him. I think there's more important stuff like the war, inflation, all that stuff that's going to have more of an impact.
Sean, it's been a delight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Sharing your wisdom.
Well, that was Sean Gregory there, senior sports correspondent with Time magazine. Waleed, your takeout?
I don't know. Part of it to me is how quickly under Donald Trump the bazaar has seemed normal. I mean, we end up in that conversation talking about this is a sporting event. You ask questions there about corruption. And as you're asking that question, I have to confess, Hamish, I'm going, surely this is a small fry example, if that's the charge that you want to make. You know, I don't want to become cliched about this, but there is something, isn't there, about the just how dramatically the Overton window seems to shift where Donald Trump is in the room.
Yeah, I do feel like we've got to at least look at that straight in the eye. Like, there are very clearly commercial interests here. It is the use of the White House for these purposes. We know what Trump does and the way he wields his authority. It's just maybe we've stopped asking each time because the answer doesn't really take you anywhere else. But I suppose the other thing for me is just really trying to register how this is going to play out over the next few weeks in line with this 250th anniversary, because this is this is an important moment for the United States. Obviously, I guess we've seen with like King Charles, for example, visiting the US recently and using those historical reference points to remind both his home country and his hosts of what these, I guess, longer term song lines and narratives mean and what they say about contemporary America. I just wonder, seeing, for example, that so many of the musicians are pulling out of the Freedom 250 concert already, how America is going to interpret this moment. That's the question that for me is really live, because I see the arguments Sean's making about the UFC representing a particular type of politics and a moment in American politics. But this is more than just about the moment. This is also the past 250 years.
Right. So you put your finger on something really interesting there. And that is, I think, when Donald Trump is the dominant presence, he is the dominant presence. And whatever it is we're talking about does by necessity reform itself around him. So I hear what you say. We're talking about, you know, the 250th anniversary of the United States. This is a landmark in the history of the Republic. All this sort of, okay. But not the point, Hamish. This is about Donald Trump. Right? This is kind of how these things happen. And it's strange because we're not used to that sort of scenario. We're used to understanding the presidency of the United States, really any political office, as an office. In some ways, the UFC thing distills it brilliantly because so much of Donald Trump's appeal, I think, and I know you've spent time in the US, you know, in and around the Trump era. I'd be interested in whether you disagree with this or not, but to me it's pretty clear that a big chunk of his appeal to people is aesthetic. There's policy, yes, there's drain the swamp, there are elements, but a lot of it is aesthetic. And the UFC is a very particular aesthetic. It makes a particular statement. And so the 250th anniversary is going to be aesthetic, but it will be aesthetic in the Trumpian style. And there just seems to be no escape from that reality for me.
Trump, obviously, as a brand, as a political brand, has had that capacity to deliver a whole range of messages, and you can almost pick and mix what you want if you are predisposed to voting for him or at least considering it. Yeah, maybe UFC does that quite neatly.
Indeed. All right, Hamish, shall we do some feedback before we go?
Yeah, let's do a little bit of feedback. Do you want to kick us off with one on our recent Poland episode?
Yes. All right. But strap in. This is quite a lengthy one. Hello to everyone at Global Roaming. Thank you for your sterling efforts. I returned yesterday from 5 weeks being a tourist in the Nordic countries, Estonia, Poland and Germany, and have caught up with your interview with the Undersecretary of State for Poland. We had guides, sometimes multiple guides, in every country. Our group is primarily made up of Americans. Every guide, without exception, mentioned Russia. Some did so with humour, some compared past experiences with Russia to the current situation, some outlined the extent of current military preparations. The language was always diplomatic, but no one could be in any doubt about the level of alarm these guides were endeavouring to convey. It was almost as if they knew they had a platform and they were not going to pussyfoot around. In my experience, this sort of frankness is quite unusual with guides who usually go out of their way not to offend anyone. There was always dead silence in the buses when the subject was raised. Awkward. In light of this, I do not think that Mr. Jagakowski was over the top in his comments in the slightest, and I thought you might be interested in an admittedly superficial but consistent piece of evidence. And that's from Chris McGregor.
Yeah, well, it was certainly consistent with the other Polish politicians we've had on the program in the past who are similarly forceful in expressing their views. And this from Tony in Tassie. Hamish and team, your program still lives up to its promise, but I do miss you on Saturdays. Nick Bryant and Global Roaming just made my Saturdays. What about shifting days? Look, at the moment, we are where we are Monday to Friday, but the good news is you can find us on the app anytime. Tony really loves the Indonesia program, says they were brilliant, but can we have more of Waleed, please? Any news for you to share, Waleed?
Yes, you can have more of me. I will be here Tuesdays as a matter of course. There will be times where other commitments get in the way and so on.
We've put a hold in his calendar for the time being, but he's a busy guy. global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Thanks to our producers, Kylie Gray and Kylie Morris. Tomorrow in your podcast feed, it's Jerry and Latika. What are they looking at, Waleed?
They'll be looking at political upheavals and protests in Turkey, or if you prefer, Turkiye, which is a lot of fun to say. So I do recommend having a go at that. See you next week.
See you then.
All right.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.